So continuing here in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, text 9, Punyogandha prithivyam cha tejas chasmi vibhavasau jivanam sarva bhuteshu tapas chasmi tapasvisu. I am the original fragrance of the earth, and I am the heat and fire. I am the life of all that lives, and I am the penance of all ascetics. Prabhupada says in the purport, punya means that which is not decomposed. Punya is original. Everything in the material world has a certain flavor or fragrance, as the flavor and fragrance in a flower, or in the earth, and water, and fire, and air, etc. The uncontaminated flavor, the original flavor, which permeates everything, is Krishna. So Prabhupada immediately getting right down to the essence of everything, which is Krishna. So again, these verses are describing how Krishna is present within everything, how one can meditate upon Krishna within all the things in the world that we interact with. And so here we see Punyogandha Prativyam Cha. He is the pure smell within the earth. So just like when you go and you smell a flower, or anything that has fragrance, but particularly let's just take like you go and find a rose and you pluck it and smell it. So that rose flavor, from the Vedic perspective, is within the earth. The earth is the repository of all scents, right? Of all, you know, smells. And so, therefore, when you, essentially what the rose plant is doing is it's withdrawing that rose smell from the earth and sort of like compressing it or bringing out that specific flavor into its flower. You see? So Krishna, he is the original fragrance that's within everything. As Prabhupada says here, he's the fragrance in a flower, in earth, in water, in fire, etc. So Krishna saturates everything. He's the quality that's within everything. Right? In other words, that's one way that you can see the Supreme Lord in material nature, is that you can recognize his qualities as they're present in nature. For example, all of you are writing on desks. So what is the specific quality of a desk? Right? It has four legs, right? What are those four legs creating? Yeah, balance. They're creating a strength, right? It's lifting up, you know, a flat surface up to where it's at a comfortable position. But those four legs are actually creating strength. You know, they have their cylindrical shape. They're meant to bear weight. So if you look at it in one sense, that power of strength that's within that desk, that's actually Krishna. Like, put your hands on the desk and push down. Go ahead. You feel how it's not going anywhere? That's strength. That's the power of strength. So that quality of strength is actually Krishna's quality. You see? Because Krishna has all the qualities in full. He's Bhagavan, right? Bhagavan means that he has all of the bhagas at their highest degree. Strength, fame, knowledge, beauty, renunciation, wealth. So wherever you see these things, you're just looking at a tiny amount of Krishna's qualities brought out into a particular object, or you might say focused or condensed into a particular object. Like if you see a very beautiful man or a very beautiful woman, then what you're looking at is actually Krishna's beauty, right? Krishna means he's the source of all beauty, all attractive. So it's just that quality, that infinite quality of beauty within Krishna has just been condensed in one particular living entity due to their piety, due to performing some pious actions. Therefore, some quality of Krishna is manifest, right? And so whatever we're attracted to, it's actually we're attracted to Krishna. When you're attracted to a beautiful person or a beautiful painting or a beautiful sound or a beautiful smell, you're simply being attracted to the beauty of Krishna. But we just don't realize it, right? Or you're attracted to someone who's strong, right? It could be, you know, Hulk Hogan or Arnold Schwarzenegger or something, right? They come in and immediately everyone's attracted. Well, not anymore because they're old, right? But back in the 80s or something, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger comes in the room. Immediately everyone's stunned, you know, because of the strength, the power. Also, he's a charismatic individual, right? In fact, devotees just met him on Ratiyatra Day when they're setting out the... he rides his bike on was it Pacific or Maine in Santa Monica. He rides up and down there to Venice Beach, and devotees met him, and he stopped and said hi and like waved to the devotees and everything. But he's a very charismatic individual, right? So there's that shakti, there's that strength, that power. So therefore he's attractive or famous. You know, he's famous, right? And therefore, you know, people recognize him. He goes riding down the street on his bike, and everyone stops and waves, right? And when we do that, nobody stops and waves, right? Maybe they wave, but it's not their open hand, you know? They're giving us some other mudra, you know? Right? So you know, that's fame. So immediately when you see someone who's famous, it's like, wow, you know? Or there was one famous person that was just here not too long ago. He was here visiting, and immediately he's like a famous British personality, or comedian, right? Immediately he was visiting here, and as soon as he walked onto the street, all these people saw him and they're like started screaming, right? These different women saw him and they started screaming and they wanted to hug him and like have their picture taken with him. So where does that, what is that? Well, it's basically he's pious enough that he is sort of by material nature's investing within him one little drop of Krishna's qualities. And Krishna is so attractive that immediately all the souls are attracted to him. You can't help it. It's irresistible, right? In other words, like the very nature of attraction itself is the soul being attracted to God. You know, and it's just a very natural thing, just like a magnet is attracted to iron. You know, you can't control it. Therefore, when the soul, therefore in conditioned existence, sees another soul manifesting one little particle of Krishna, immediately we're mesmerized. Isn't that amazing? So punya gandha prativyam cha. You know, Prabhupada is making the point here that, you know, just as this punya gandha, this original fragrance, which is then manifested through the earth into flowers and things like that, that original quality is Krishna. Okay? And that's really the sum and substance of all these verses here describing Krishna's glories. Tejas chasmi vibhavasu. So Krishna, he is the light and fire, right? Prabhupada says, vibhavasu means fire. Without fire, we cannot run factories, we cannot cook, etc. And that fire is Krishna. The heat in the fire is Krishna. According to Vedic medicine, indigestion is due to a low temperature in the belly. So even for digestion, fire is needed. So he's also Vaishvanara. He's the fire of digestion. So, you know, the emphasis Prabhupada's making here is that fire or heat or digestion, you know, this is a certain quality of the element of fire that's transformative, right? You transform one thing into another, you release energy, right? And it causes, and everything is therefore running upon this fire. Even your own physical body, it's all dependent upon this quality. So with this particular quality of fire, Prabhupada's kind of emphasizing our dependence, you know, that society is based upon this. We can't do anything without fire. Even you see, there's the light bulb here, the filament. Electricity is fire. So that light by which we're seeing everything here is Krishna, right? And here we have a heater. Don't bother turning it on. Probably years of dust will blow out of it or something, right? But nevertheless, you know, we can't even sustain ourselves. We can't live comfortably without this quality of heat. Nor can we digest our food and have the energy to live. In fact, as Holiness Radhanath Swami, I remember listening in one lecture, he was mentioning, actually he was here in the temple room, he was mentioning how essentially he, like everything in the world is running on the power of the sun, right? Even the vehicles, even the cars. If you look at the gasoline that's used, it's actually coming from the dinosaurs, right? Or not even the dinosaurs directly, but you have like the different jungle plants and things back from the prehistoric era. So they've all turned into coal and oil. And so that's what we're using. But where does their energy come from? It comes from the sun, right? And so it's that sun power. Everything's ultimately solar powered. The fire that's within oil or gasoline, it's actually ultimately, originally coming from the sun. You see? And so Krishna is that too. He's the gasoline. When you fill up at the gas tank, you can remember Krishna, right? Okay, so continuing here, it says, in Krishna consciousness, we become aware that earth, water, fire, air, and every active principle, all chemicals and all material elements are due to Krishna. All right? So, tapas chasvi, he is that power of penance, right? You see within all things, like for example, if you go to college or something like that, that penance that you do, that, in other words, in order to achieve anything requires hard work. You know, that's no matter what. You can't be successful, whether it be materially or spiritually, and yes, unless you're willing to work hard and essentially put aside your immediate gratification for the future. So that power to actually achieve things, that's also Krishna. Okay? And Jivanam Sarva Bhuteshu, he's the life within all living entities. So when you see other living beings, you can also remember Krishna, because he is that life force within them. All right? So these verses are giving us the power to sort of look into everyday life and to find Krishna, to see Krishna, to remember the absolute truth. So let's take a look at text 10. Bijam mam sarva bhutanam vidipata sanatanam buddhir buddhimitam masmi tejas tejas vinam maham. O son of Pritha, know that I am the original seed of all existences, the intelligence of the intelligence, and the prowess of all powerful men. Prabhupada says here, Bijam means seed. Krishna is the seed of everything. There are various living entities, movable and inert. Birds, beasts, men, and many other living creatures are moving living entities. Trees and plants, however, are inert. They cannot move, but only stand. Every living entity is contained within the scope of 8,400,000 species of life. Some of them are moving and some of them are inert. In all cases, however, the seed of their life is Krishna. So when looking at the different living entities in the material world, there's basically two classifications. There's the moving and non-moving. Right? That's kind of how the Vedas divide everything up. So Krishna is the seed of everything. If you go into like a, you know, you look scientifically at what they would call, you know, like you sort of look at what is the origin of all creation. If you go back that far, if you trace back your father's father, you know, you follow your DNA, right? You know, what's your rDNA or your mDNA, right? Not R, your yDNA. So then, you know, if you follow that, trace that all the way back, it'll eventually get to the Supreme Lord. And that's the same with all the different species of life, right? He's the cause of all causes. He's the origin of all. So Krishna is the bija, the seed. So just like you look at a plant, like a tree, it's marvelous. Like if you look at a banyan tree, it's gigantic. And yet the banyan tree seed is very, very tiny. And yet that entire tree is in essence contained within that tiny seed, right? Everything is there within it. I mean, we know like for DNA or whatever, it's in a very compressed form, but the potential is there within the seed. So everything that you see and experience within existence, it ultimately flowered out of this one seed of Krishna, right? Everything that we experience was actually in Krishna at one time, compressed within Krishna with the potential of creation. Right? We're sort of standing on something that has unfolded out of the original source, out of God. Okay? Isn't that interesting? It's like, I don't know, I'm just kind of thinking, like when you're a little kid and you have these pop-up books, right? And they're the coolest thing, right? You turn the page and it whoop and it pops up and turns all the trees stand up and everything like that. So it's the same thing, you know, the universe in a sense has popped out of Krishna. It's sort of spreading out of Krishna like that. So everything that we experience is really just arising naturally out of him. Like that. Isn't that incredible? So he's the seed of all existence. Let's jump ahead here in the purport. It says, as the root of a tree maintains the whole tree, Krishna, being the original root of all things, maintains everything in this material manifestation. This is also confirmed in the Vedic literature, Katha Upanishad 2.2.13, Nityo Nityanam Chetanash Chetananam Ekubahunam Yovadathati Kaman. So he's the prime eternal among all eternals. He's the prime living entity of all living entities, and he alone is maintaining all life. Okay, so this, of course, is a very famous verse from the Katha Upanishad. So there's the one nitya, the one eternal, and then the nityanam, the many eternals. There's the one chetana, the one conscious being, and then chetananam, there's the many conscious beings. So there's Krishna as the one singular, and then there's the many, which is all the jivas, right? And what is their relationship? Eko bahunam, the one to the many, yovadadhati kaman, is fulfilling all their desires. So the, you know, essentially everything that we desire, it's happening due to Krishna. For example, I'm desiring to speak right now, right? And so that speaking power is directly coming from Krishna. He's the one actually doing it. He's the one giving us the power to fulfill our desires. The living entity is, in essence, sort of like an observer. We don't really do anything in material nature except desire, right? And experience the interactions of our previous activities. So we're more or less just watching as a soul. We're pure consciousness watching material existence happening and identifying with it. But the power for material existence to happen, the power for us to speak, the power for us to see, to hear, to smell, to interact with each other, to experience things, to attempt to enjoy things, to suffer things. So that power is actually all given by Krishna. He's creating the whole experience of reality. Just like if you have The Matrix, that movie The Matrix. So, you know, it's like we're sort of like plugged into The Matrix, but The Matrix itself, everything that's happening within it, it's all going on, you know, by the power of, I forget what it's called, the machine or whatever, right? The main sort of conscious machine or robot, an artificial intelligence that is there. So similarly, it's like the whole matrix of reality, it's actually going on by the power of Krishna. It's going on by his desire, by his will. And therefore, everything that we experience, all of our desires, everything that we wish to experience in life, it's actually simply manifest due to him, due to his desire. He's creating the whole illusory material energy, giving it the power to function. Okay? So, finishing, it says, one cannot do anything without intelligence. And Krishna also says that he's the root of all intelligence. Unless a person is intelligent, he cannot understand the Supreme Personality of Krishna. Okay? So the idea being, as it says here, buddhimatam asmi, Krishna is the buddhi of those who have buddhi, right? Of those who are, you know, especially intelligent. He is that intelligence. So whenever you see an individual with powerful intelligence who's able to see and understand reality clearly, right, who's able to have the highest understanding, whose knowledge and wisdom of reality is very strong and powerful, and therefore can, you know, effectively interact with material energy in a powerful way, that's actually Krishna's power. Right? Say, like, for example, Lord Brahma. He's the most intelligent living being. He's able to create the demigod in charge of the sub-creation. He's able to order the entire material universe due to his powerful intelligence and the tapasya he performed, right? He performed tapasya and worshipped the Supreme Lord, and he was blessed with the power of creation. But he's so extremely intelligent, he's able to manifest that intelligence in reality. It's like they say, what is it called? Intelligent design, you know, like certain scientists are able to look at the universe and due to their own intelligence, they're able to perceive that actually there's intelligence in creation. It's not just happening whimsically, right? It's not chaotic like an explosion, but rather there's some order, there's some purpose that's there. And if you're intelligent, you can detect that. You could see, just like if you go into a car, you know, you can see this is actually made by someone. It's functioning. It didn't just randomly appear. It's actually functioning due to some design that's there. So that designer is essentially Lord Brahma, right? You're looking at his, and you're able to, if you're intelligent, you're able to perceive his intelligence within creation. And ultimately, that intelligence of Brahma is upon which the entire material creation is ordered. That's actually coming from Krishna. It's a particle of Krishna's intelligence. You see? So the Supreme Lord's intelligence is, you know, pervading the, essentially, whenever we see some powerful, intelligent force, you're just appreciating the intelligence of the Supreme Lord. All right? So let's continue on in text 11. Balam balavatam chaham kamadaga vavarjatam dharmavidudho bhuteshu kamosmi bhadatarshabha. I am the sex of the strong, devoid of passion. Strength of the strong, devoid of passion and desire. I am sex life, which is not contrary to religious principles, O Lord of the Bharatas. So balam balavatam chaham. So just as he is the beauty within the beautiful, right? Just as he's the intelligence within the intelligent, so he's the strength within the strong. Kama raga vivarjitam dharma dvidudho bhuteshu. So he is also that kama, or that passion, that sex life, which is raga vivarjitam, which is devoid of raga or attachment, and it's dharma avidudha, and it's not against religious principles. So kama is an incredibly powerful force within nature, right? We see, especially, you know, in human beings, you see that the romance between man and woman and the subsequent family life, this is all due to kama. And within the animal kingdom also, you see, you know, it's springtime, right? Everything awakens, all the flowers open. and everything and all the animals began to reproduce. So this powerful force of sexual attraction within nature, which is, you know, essentially we are all experiencing that powerful force as long as it is according to the principles of Dharma, right? And it's devoid of undue attachment, that's also Krishna. In other words, he's purified sex life. Just like he said with the punya gandha prativyam cha, right? He's the pure essential quality or characteristic of scent. That's Krishna, you know, in its purest form, in its most original form, scent is Krishna. So similarly, kama in its purest original form is also Krishna. Yeah? Now, whenever kama is done in a way, sex life or romantic attraction between male and female, whenever that's done in a way which is against dharma, then it's becoming perverse, right? You might say when it's no longer in harmony with the laws of God. For example, illicit sex or sex outside of marriage. So that is actually not, you know, that's considered a perverted form of kama. It's not in its pure form. Or sex life, which is raga, there's too much attachment, right? So this, you know, this kind of intense, obsessive sex life, like for example, you have these stalkers, you know? Like if you have, you're a famous celebrity and you have a mansion, and so there's some crazy person jumps the wall and comes running up to you while you're eating dinner with your family, you know, I love you! I love you! Right? And you're trying to call security, you know, even nowadays they have these, what are they called? Safe boxes or some safe rooms, safety rooms, where they actually like, you know, okay, the stalker comes and he opens your glass door and comes walking in while you're having food, dinner with your family. So then you hustle all your family into the safe room. You know, it's like a big bulletproof glass room right in the middle of your otherwise peaceful and happy, prosperous family life, right? And therefore, you know, you huddle your family in there. And if he pulls out a gun and starts shooting at the glass, you know, it can take a few hits, you know, before it shatters. And hopefully your private security will get there in time, or maybe even the police, right, will get there in time. So that's raga, right? There's too much attachment. It gets to the point of being insane, right? Raga, or this raja, this passion, it degrades to the state of krodha and anger. Krodat bhavati sammoha. And then you become bewildered. Sammohat smriti vi brahmaha. And you lose your memory, you know, what is reality? Smriti brahmshad burinashat. And then you lose your intelligence. You lose your very vision of what is reality, you know. What do you mean? You know me, right? I shook hands with you 2 years ago at the concert, right? You looked in my eyes and I looked in yours and I knew that it was love. And you're going to, you know, and now the love has reached such a level that only the most romantic thing is for us to die together, right? This is what people do. So this is the buddhi nashat, you know, they're completely crazy, right? They have to, and then when the police grab them and haul them out, then immediately they're screaming and shouting and fighting, you know, no, no, right? And it's total madness, you can see it. So this is a sort of perverted form of kama, okay? So, you know, the distinction is being made that Krishna's the origin of all these things in its purest form. And therefore you see in the pastimes of Krishna and Vrindavan, you see Radha and Krishna and the gopis, this is actually the origin of kama, material and spiritual. This is the origin, but it's nothing like material kama. You see, the relationship between Krishna and his feminine potency, that's actually has nothing to do with material energy at all. In fact, it's compared to gold in comparison to iron, right? Material sex life, even in its highest form, is a dull reflection. Just as the material world is ultimately a reflection of the spiritual world. Okay, that'll be described later in the 15th chapter with the banyan tree of material existence. All right, so kamosmi bharadarshabha. So Krishna is that powerful, or you know that strength of the strong, and also the purified or original sex life. Prabhupada says here in the purport, the strong man's strength should be applied to protect the weak, not for personal aggression. So it's a very important point, you know. We generally, when someone develops some power, they immediately start bullying other people. That's kind of how it is in the material world. Even whether it be political power or, you know, whatever, as long as one group gets into power, they immediately start pushing down and abusing the other groups, right? And then those groups rise up and rebel, and they eventually get power, and then they start abusing, you know, the person that abused them, right? So it's kind of like in material consciousness, at least in Kali Yuga, in this degraded time frame, power is synonymous with abuse, right? As soon as, you know, isn't there a famous saying like that? Like, absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? That power and abuse are practically the same thing. So Prabhupada's making the point here that there is a purified form of strength, and the mood that accompanies it is protection. And that's really the mood of the kshatriya or the king or the ideal leader, is in this mood of protection. Therefore, you'll see, you know, whenever, like, the nature of dharma, one of the ways that you can see dharma is it arouses emotion in people. It arouses the pleasure of emotion. You know, dharma, as soon as you see it, you immediately feel something in your heart, you know, rise up. Therefore, when you see, there's like right now, there's a hurricane in Texas. And then you see, you know, like average people who sort of come together and help each other and save each other. You know, you'll have like some dude, he doesn't know this person, you know, but he risks his life to like dive into the water and drag out like a woman and her baby. And immediately people see that and they feel, you know, emotionally, there's a rising up of intense feeling, and people, you know, watch the videos and cry and stuff, right? So that's because you're seeing dharma. That's what, you know, dharma has that power to actually give you real, true material happiness or kama, right? It has the power to sort of manifest a powerful, emotional, pleasurable response. So, you know, in essentially all the human relationships that we have, such as marriage or parents between children, if you actually perform those according to the laws of God, according to dharma, then you'll experience emotional sustenance from those, right? If you're able to align yourself, then those same types of feelings, that's what you're actually supposed to be experiencing through your family life, through your friends and stuff like that. But that requires you to follow the laws of God, right? So, but anyway, if you see, you know, there's someone, you know, rescues him, or a police officer, for example, you know, like if you see videos of a police officer abusing someone or beating someone, then this is, you know, everybody condemns it, you know, people become very angry. But if you see the same video of a police officer, like, protecting someone, you know, like, what if he throws himself, there's someone shooting at someone, and he throws himself in front to try to take the bullet for that person, immediately that police officer is glorified, you know? Or even sometimes you'll see the police officer, well, there's a homeless man, and the, you know, officer doesn't know he's being recorded. And then they show him, he's like taking off, or he's buying them shoes and putting it on the homeless man's feet and buying him dinner and giving it to him. And immediately people feel, wow, you know, there's this powerful emotional feeling from watching it. You feel good. It makes you feel good. They even have videos on YouTube like that called, like, what is it, like, Restoring Faith in Humanity. Right, if you go on YouTube and type Restoring Faith in Humanity, then there's all these videos of dharma, basically. Humans behaving according to the laws of God or in harmony with the laws of God. That's how you're supposed to be behaving all the time. Right? Like that's actually, you know, instead of having a religious preacher talk about how to, you know, you should do this and you should do this, just show one of those videos, you know, Restoring Faith in Humanity. And then immediately you get the sense of what is dharma. Right? Compassion, humility, service to others. And these are required. You know, this is a required beginning to practice any yoga system. Right? Generally, that's called religion. And then once you become qualified on a religious level, once you have these qualities of dharma, then, and you have, you know, you're an individual who moves through the world with compassion, with unlimited forgiveness and humility, and you're kind to all others, and you're basically living for the benefit of others and trying to help them, then once you take to the process of true spiritual life, which is meditation, focusing the mind, right? Directing the mind on the absolute truth, yeah? And, you know, gradually cultivating the ability to control the mind and control the senses and devote yourself completely and, you know, in a very meditative, devotional mind to the absolute truth, to the personality of Godhead, to God himself. Once you're, you know, once you have those qualities, then it becomes very easy to practice yoga, the science of focusing your mind on God. And so it's sort of a preliminary thing to develop this sort of dharma. So when you see, you know, a leader of society has this particular quality of dharma, or someone who has strength or power, and they're using it to protect others, then you can immediately, you know, that's the natural state of strength. That's actually what it's supposed to be. But when you see that strength being using to abuse others or dominate others or exploit others, then that's adharma, right? It's not a very good thing. And so if you look through human history, that's what you see. You see, you know, different individuals forming groups and essentially fighting each other and dominating and exploiting each other. You know, developing some strength and power, whether it be through, you know, invention or intelligence or whatever it may be, and then using that power to dominate and exploit others. And everybody takes turns and goes back and forth doing that to each other, right? So that's actually adharma, okay? So when Krishna is the balam balavatam chaham, he's actually that quality of strength in its pure form, in its protective form, yeah? When you see, you know, there's a police officer risking his life to save a kitty cat, you know, or he pulls it out or whatever, or, you know, then immediately people feel, you know, that, wow, you know, that's such a beautiful thing. So when you see that, that's one little particle of the true strength of Krishna, you see? So this also gives us some insight into Krishna's personality. Because he, in other words, if that beautiful experience you have, seeing someone utilize their strength to protect, and they sacrifice themselves, then what you're looking at is one little particle of Krishna's own quality of self-sacrifice and protection. Right? The very power of God is behind that. You know what I mean? Like with the Supreme Lord, all of his power and strength, which is inconceivable, that's how he uses it. He uses it out of compassion, out of protection. He's a very protecting person. Does that make sense? Like if you were to actually see God do his thing, you know, utilize his strength for protecting others, if you could truly see that and understand that, which he's doing it all the time, you would immediately, wow, this is so incredible, so beautiful. That feeling you feel when you watch that video of someone protecting another, that feeling, that's just one little tiny particle of when you actually look at God and his same quality of using strength to protect. His own, you might say, honor and virtue and self-sacrifice. Those qualities are in him to an immense degree, right? Like one time I saw a video of there was like this, I think he's like a teenage boy, and there was this woman who, it was somewhere in China, and she fell off like a subway platform, and she fell onto the tracks or whatever, and everyone was kind of just standing around watching and, you know, doing nothing, right? And then he came like running out of nowhere, you know, and just like practically dove off the walkway down into the tracks. But like, in a, you know, it's very heroic, you know, like he just went full bore, like no thought for himself, no thought of his own danger. And immediately he grabbed her and dragged her up onto the platform, and other people helped too. And, you know, and he himself came up before the train pulled into the station, right? So that's, you're seeing that, and it inspires us. It causes an emotional change within us, right? It's sort of an admiration of virtue. But that's just one little particle of the quality of Krishna, who has that quality in an extreme level, like in a level that's inconceivable to us. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm just trying to convey that kind of that arousal of feeling and admiration you feel. Imagine if you could see Krishna in his full strength and how he uses it. So another side of this is that we can take shelter of him, right? He's a loving Lord, you know, like you can fully be under the shelter of God, and he in entering into that relationship with him is a, he's perfectly qualified to have that relationship. You can trust him, right? Okay. All right. So let's see. Let's take a look at text 12. Ye chayeva saptika bhava rajasas tamasashchaye mate eve titan vidhi natvaham te shute mai. Know that all states of being, be they of goodness, passion, or ignorance, are manifested by my energy. I am in one sense everything, but I am independent. I am not under the modes of material nature, for they, on the contrary, are within me. Prabhupada says here, all material activities in the world are being conducted under the three modes of material nature. Although these material modes of nature are emanations from the Supreme Lord Krishna, he is not subject to them. For instance, under the state laws, one may be punished. For the king, the lawmaker, is not subjected to the law. Similarly, all the modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance, are emanations from the Supreme Lord Krishna. But Krishna is not subject to the material nature. Okay? So, ye chaiva saptika bhava. Rajasas, tamasas, chaye. So everything is made of the modes of material nature. So essentially, you know, and of course, this is going to be a major topic in the latter portion of the Bhagavad Gita. And you have in the 14th chapter, the 17th chapter, the 18th chapter, Krishna goes into great detail about the three modes of material nature and how, is basically, that's how Krishna wants us to analyze material nature. He wants us to be able to look at things and to see with our intelligence, oh, there's rajas, there's tamas, there's sattva. Right? These qualities are manifest. And why does he want us to do that? Well, it's so that we can choose sattva. Yeah? It's so that we can cultivate the mode of goodness. And then by cultivating the mode of goodness, which again is synonymous with dharma, we were just talking about, you know, when you see that dharma, it has that power on you. So that mode of goodness is synonymous with dharma. So we're meant to cultivate those particular qualities and then use that as a springboard into transcendence. You know, situate ourselves in the mode of goodness and simultaneously do service to the Supreme Lord. Focus the mind on the Supreme Lord. Hear and chant the qualities of Krishna. Hear Krishna's name. Hear his pastimes. Associate with his devotees. Right? Render unalloyed love to him. But we're supposed to be situated in the mode of goodness to do that. And therefore, we have to be able to find the mode of goodness, right? We have to be able to choose it. We have to be able to cultivate it. It's like you cultivate anything, you know, like you want to become a successful businessman, then you have to cultivate certain attitudes and ideas and desires, right? You have to develop within yourself, you know, an understanding of how to do business, but you have to also develop a certain mentality, you know, like you can associate, and that's essentially by association. You're going to choose, you know, okay, I got to find a businessman who's a real businessman. You know, like saying he's got to, and sometimes they're not businessmen. They're not always gentle, you know? Like sometimes you find a real, like, okay, you get a bunch of guys work in an office, you know, in Manhattan or something like that, and they all wear expensive suits, and they're all very gentle with each, well, generally not always, but, you know, there's a very professional way of interacting. Sometimes when you meet real vaishyas, real businessmen, they don't really care what you think, you know, they just speak the truth, you know, this is it, you know. You know, I want my profit, or you know, like they're very direct and very, very clear, and they have a very clear understanding of what it means to own their own business and to have pride in that, and to how to essentially maneuver in a way that they make a profit. You know, and they're very straightforward about it, right? So you find those people and you associate with them, and you develop that mentality, you develop that attitude, and that'll make you a good businessman, right? So in the same way, you associate with people in the mode of goodness. You associate with people who are Krishna conscious, you know, who are God conscious. You associate with people who follow dharma, right? Who follow principles of religion and essentially, you know, practice compassion, forgiveness, tolerance, all these things, and you'll develop that too. Okay? So that's one of the major lessons of the Bhagavad Gita, is how to understand the construction of material nature. And then to cultivate the mode of goodness with that understanding. Okay? So, mat eveti tan vidhi natvam te shute mai. So, even though all these things, Krishna is essentially everything. Mat eveti tan vidhi. Everything you see is Krishna, the material energy is Krishna, but simultaneously, it's not Krishna. Simultaneously, he's above it. So, this is another important lesson in the Bhagavad Gita, right? The relationship between Krishna and the material energy, it's his vibhuti, it's his opulence. Yeah, he even says that later, behold my mystic opulence. But he mentions this quite a few times in the Bhagavad Gita, like in the 9th chapter. He'll essentially say, you know, yes, the material energy is part of me, right? When you're touching all this stuff, this desk, or, you know, you're seeing everything in the material energy, you're interacting with it, you're directly interacting with Krishna's energy, with God's energies. But at the same time, even though it is, in one sense, God, it's not God, because he's above it, he's beyond it, he's transcendental to it. Yeah? And that's, as it mentioned in the beginning of this chapter, bina prakritid ashtadha, the material elements, this material existence, subtle and gross, is actually bina, it's separated. There's a distinction between Krishna and his energies. It's of a lower quality. And Prabhupada gives us an analogy here to understand. That you have, you know, like the king of a state and a monarchy, you know, he creates the laws and he's in charge of the land. In one sense, the land, and actually in a traditional sort of medieval way of looking at things, the land is none different from God or the king, right? In fact, that's one of the whole principles of like, in the Arthurian tales, like King Arthur, you know, in order to heal the land, you know, the king has to receive the Holy Grail and drink of it and become healed, and then the kingdom is healed when the king is healed, right? So there's this traditional ancient idea that the king and the land are one, you know? But at the same time, the king is different from the land, right? He's also an individual, yeah? And the king creates the laws of the land, and that the king is not underneath those laws. So similarly, Krishna, he creates the laws of reality. Everything is going on because he dictates, you know, these are the laws, and now let it function according to the laws, and therefore it does. But he himself is above the law. Right, when he descends as an avatar, he's andantadasta paramanuchayantadastam. He's situated within the hearts of all living entities, and when the Supreme Lord manifests into the world in a visible form with which you can interact, then he doesn't operate under the laws of nature. He's anadid. He's unlimited. He's without beginning. He's without end. Even his physical body, or you know, he doesn't have a body like ours. It's not physical, right? It's his own internal potency directly manifest. So it doesn't interact according to the laws of nature. He can do whatever he likes, whenever he likes, right? Similarly, you see the deity form of the Lord. You know, Krishna can eat by seeing. You know, so he's angani yasya sakalendriya vritti banti, right? One of his senses can perform the function of any other sense. So Krishna doesn't obey the laws of the universe. He's above them. Okay? Any questions about this stuff? Okay. So let's continue here in text 13. All right. So Krishna, he's talking, now he's sort of going to shift the topic more. And instead of talking about how he pervades material nature or how he can be understood through looking at the opulences and qualities of nature, he's going to talk about how the three modes essentially conduct everything, and then by surrendering unto him, you can transcend the three modes. So just like, you know, we said, the king is above the law, so if you surrender to the king, then you can also rise above the law, right? He can pardon you. You know, like if you're a thief or something like that, and you're about to be punished, then if you run to the king and you pay your respects, you know, please save me, and the king may feel merciful to you and also raise you above the law. Okay, you're forgiven. Yeah? So similarly, if you surrender under the Supreme Lord, you can cross beyond the ocean of material existence, which there's no way to cross beyond samsara without that. Even if you're not a devotee, even if you're an Ashtanga yogi or a Jnana yogi or a Karma yogi, in order to make the final move out of samsara, there has to be that blessing there. You have to receive permission. You see? So it's by surrender to the Supreme Lord that one can cross beyond the three modes of material nature. He says here in text 13, Krishna says, Tribhir gunamayir bhavayir ebhi sarvamidam jagat mohitam nabhijanati mam ebhya padamavayam. Deluded by the three modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance, the whole world does not know me, whom above the modes and inexhaustible. So the whole world is enchanted by the three modes of material nature, Prabhupada says. Those who are bewildered by these three modes cannot understand that transcendental to this material nature is the Supreme Lord Krishna. So this is a very important point. There is a curtain. Yeah, there's a curtain of maya which covers the living entity. Naham prakasha sarvasya yoga maya samavrataha. Right? There's a yoga maya samavrataha. There's a curtain of yoga maya. The power of maya is essentially covering our eyes, and we can't see the Supreme Lord, even though he's everywhere. It's blocked to our vision. So that's deliberate, because it's our own desire that happens. Because we've come here as jivas with the desire to enjoy the material world. We essentially want to pretend to be God. We want to pretend to be the enjoyer and dominator of this material energy. And so you can't do that if you see God all the time, right? It ruins the party, yeah? Like, you know, Krishna essentially has to vanish from our vision. Otherwise, it ruins it if we try to be God. If you're trying to be the enjoyer, and everywhere you look, you see God, and you're overwhelmed by his glory, and you see that he's the enjoyer of everything, and that nothing exists but his energy, and that everything belongs to him, and everything is meant for his enjoyment, you can't try to enjoy, right? It's just this material energy, its real position is it's for him. It's for him to enjoy. It's his energy. It's God. So how can you try to enjoy God in a selfish way? How can you try to, like, you know, grab onto him and somehow, you know, use him for your enjoyment? It can't happen. And it just, as soon as, if you're conscious of him, there's no way to be an illusion. There's no way to be in the mood of the enjoyer. If he's present, all of your desire to enjoy vanishes. So in order to fulfill that desire, he has to disappear. Right? He has to create an illusion, right? He has to facilitate your illusion so that you can live in an existence where he appears not to exist. Where, you know, you can live in a dream where it appears that it's not God all around you at every moment. Okay? So that's the yoga maya samavrataha. It's a curtain. And in order to have that curtain removed, you really have to purify your heart of the desire to enjoy. You have to purify your heart of the desire to not see Krishna. Right? You have to purify your heart of the desire to live in an existence where Krishna is not always present before you. Yeah. So sometimes it's like, as devotees, we try to somehow or other, you know, remember Krishna. But why do we forget Krishna? Why do we go into Maya? You know, why do we waste time absorbed in things that are illusory? Well, because we don't want to remember Krishna at all times. You know, we want to forget him. Deep within us, there's this desire to essentially enjoy separately from God and to forget him, you know, and therefore to be an illusion. So he's not going to remove that illusion until you want him to, until you essentially have cultivated your love for him enough to where you actually want him to be the Supreme Lord. You want him to be the enjoyer at all times. You want to see Krishna happy. You want to see him satisfied. You want to see him enjoying his energies. Does that make sense? So it's sort of like a cultivation of your own love for Krishna and the vanishing of your envy towards Krishna. That's going to be mentioned in a latter verse of this chapter, right? At the foundation of existence is really we desire to be Krishna, we desire to be the enjoyer, and we're envious towards Krishna. We don't want him to be the enjoyer. We're kind of upset that he is. It's like we're grumpy about it, you know? Oh, you know, why is that Krishna get to be the enjoyer, you know? And therefore, we're sort of like, you know, it's like a child, when a child doesn't get its toy or something like that, it's all fussy and angry, you know? So we're sort of turned away from Krishna. You know, why does Krishna get to be the enjoyer, right? I want to be the enjoyer. And therefore, we're rebellious, you know? And we're looking at his energy, the material energy, in a mood of enjoyment. And in order to do that, we directly block out Krishna, or rather this yoga maya samavrata, this curtain blocks out Krishna around us so that we can try to be an illusion, we can try to enjoy. Right? It's sort of like descended around us so that we can be an illusion and try to enjoy. But if we cultivate our love for Krishna, then that enviousness towards Krishna goes away, and we want him to enjoy, right? We want him to be happy and satisfied. We want him, and at all times, we're trying to offer everything to him and see him happy and do everything for his pleasure. You see? And essentially that then gives us happiness. Our happiness comes from seeing Krishna happy. And we totally forget about ourselves, right? Like Arjuna is concerned about his shreyas, remember? He's concerned about his own enjoyment. So really, we should cultivate a mood where we're only concerned with Krishna's enjoyment. We love Krishna so much, we just want him to be happy. And at every moment, we're filled with the desire to give him pleasure and the extreme transcendental happiness which comes from that. Like when you cultivate that desire to make Krishna happy and you're absorbed in that, constantly giving to Krishna, giving to Krishna, giving to Krishna, then you become very ecstatic. You become filled with bliss, right? You become more satisfied than when you're in this kind of dark illusion of a world separate from God that you're trying to enjoy. So that's essentially what bhakti yoga is to develop that love for Krishna, that non-enviousness towards Krishna. It's just like, for example, like, you know, as we move through this world, you experience so many different people that are mean to you or bad to you, or they backstab you, or, you know, they treat you badly, they abuse you, they take advantage of you, and you become filled with a kind of like an anger towards them, an envy. You know, how could this person do this to me? You know, I don't, you know, and even if you're not envious, it's kind of like, well, all right, I'm not angry at them. I don't hate them, but, you know, I don't really want them to be happy either. You know what I mean? Right? But if somehow you can summon within yourself the capacity to, in a sense, love your enemy, right? To actually look at that individual and pray for them and try to be their well-wisher, even though they hate you and they call you names and they scream at you and, you know, and they're irrational and crazy and just filled with rage. And if you can look at that person and instead of being angry, you can actually pray and, you know, please, Krishna, please be merciful to them. And more than that, please make them happy. Right? Even though they've treated you so badly, please, you know, I don't want revenge, you know? Please, God, take vengeance on them. No, I don't want vengeance. I don't want revenge. I just want them to be happy. I want them to be peaceful, right? And you may feel that way, and you, all of a sudden, if you pray like that, you know, you may experience, wait a minute, you know, they don't deserve that, right? No, that's okay. Even though they don't deserve it, I want them to be happy. And if somehow you can push through that feeling to where you're willing to have them be happy, that's actually love. You know, you're truly loving that individual, right? You're selflessly trying to help that individual. And so that's what we do in life. We're cultivating, you know, as Vaishnavas, we're trying to cultivate that relationship with everyone, but especially towards the Supreme Lord. We want to have unalloyed love for Him. We want Him to be satisfied, not ourselves, right? And the more you cultivate that, the more you merge, your consciousness merges into transcendence, the more absorbed you come in, the more absorbed in Krishna you become. And when you become absorbed like that, then immediately, very quickly, Krishna mentions in the Bhagavad Gita, then very quickly you enter into transcendence. Okay? All right. So let's take a look here in this purport. We'll just read a few lines and then we'll end for the day. Prabhupada mentions here, he talks about brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras, which are essentially our material existence. We are conditioned by different bodies, and they have different qualities, different characteristics, which are due to the modes of nature. But Prabhupada mentions here, however, these designations are not permanent. This is in the middle of the second paragraph. I may either be a brahmana, kshatriya, vaishya, or whatever. In any case, this life is temporary. But although life is temporary, we do not know what we are going to be in the next life. By the spell of this illusory energy, we consider ourselves in terms of this bodily conception of life, and we thus think that we are American, Indian, Russian, or Brahmana, Hindu, Muslim, etc. And if we become tangled with the modes of material nature, then we forget the Supreme Personality of Godhead who is behind all these modes. So this is a good warning. So it's very easy, due to the bodily concept of life, we identify ourselves by race, right? By ethnic background, by political, economic class, or by national designation. I'm an American, I'm Chinese, you know, I'm Indian, or this or that. And, you know, all these groups, they're essentially fighting, right? That's what these groups are. That people form groups in order to compete, in order to fight for the power to enjoy, right? It's like gangs. It's like, you know, in Los Angeles, you have street gangs, you know? And then, you know, no, we're from 115th Street. No, we're from 118th Street. You know, that's it. You know, like, we're going to fight to the death, you know? Over, you know, over an alleyway, right? It's stupid. But people form groups in order to help each other dominate, right? People form groups in order to collectivize their power so they can essentially control and exploit another individual, another group that's smaller. So that's what all these different designations in essence are. And so as transcendentalists, if we allow ourselves to be drawn into that, then very quickly we forget the Supreme Lord because they're illusory, right? Like if you watch the news or something, you get absorbed in politics, you know, like, you know, America versus South Korea, or, you know, whatever, this race against that race, or this thing, and then you become enraged, you know, you take sides, right? You take your own side, quote unquote, right? And you become enraged and absorbed in sort of the tennis game, you're going back and forth of people trying to somehow dominate each other. And if you do that, then you can't remember Krishna, because you're absorbed in the illusion, where Krishna is beyond the illusion. Therefore, true religious people, they don't fight amongst each other, right? Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, people who are truly realizing God, who's beyond these designations, they're not going to fight with each other. That's on the material platform. And when religious people fight against each other, it actually blocks their vision of seeing God. It blocks their ability to see God because it's fully within the realm of material nature. And it's fully within the realm of illusion. Whereas people who actually realize God are able to appreciate and understand each other. They're able to see, oh, wow, you know, I see God within you. You know, I see God within your tradition, right? You see a rabbi praying, or, you know, Christian sees a rabbi praying. I mean, wow, you know, I can detect it. I know what God is because I've seen a little bit of God. You know, I've experienced some God. I could see you've got God too, right? Or, you know, whatever, a Muslim or a Hindu, you know, instead of attacking each other, you actually see, wow, you know, there's God there. It's unmistakable, right? And then they can actually unify and move in and assist each other to move into the higher level, the transcendental level of consciousness. Okay? All right. So thank you very much. All glories to Prabhupada.